In the early days of Christianity, the church fathers often cited these texts and other prophetic texts similar to them to try to prove that God had never wanted the sacrificial system. Some early church theologians used these passages to suggest that God had actually given the sacrificial laws to the Jews as a punishment to them. They argued against the Jewish people, claiming that Jesus had done away with the sacrifices because God had always hated the Jews. That doesn't make sense. If God always hated the sacrifices, why did he command the children of Israel to bring them in the first place? Why did he state over and over that he was pleased with them? A better explanation comes from a more careful reading of the prophets. When the prophets seem to speak against the sacrificial system, they are not condemning the mode of worship, they are condemning the worshipers. In every instance, the prophetic rebuke is directed toward the immoral, the disobedient people among the Israelites who were violating the covenant of Torah while continuing to go through the motions of the sacrificial system. Though their hearts were far from God, they continued to perform their religious rituals. I can compare this to, imagine a wicked womanizer who beats his wife and cheats on her, but continues to faithfully attend church every Sunday and to take communion with the rest of the congregation. The religious ritual is meaningless, and it's an insult to God. Or suppose the same fellow, after beating his wife and cheating on her, dutifully sends her a bouquet of roses. Would she be pleased to receive the flowers? Hardly. She would say, "Your flowers are an abomination to me." In the same way, God hates religious rituals when they are performed hypocritically. And this should be a warning to all of us. We have to be careful not to develop any sense of right standing with God because of ritual observances. God is interested in the state of our hearts. Our outward rituals should reflect our inward condition. Okay, so far we've learned about burnt offerings, only one of the five types of sacrifices described in these opening chapters of Leviticus. So we're going to press on now and learn about the other four, starting in Leviticus chapter 2, verse 1. And this is just going to be a quick flyover. Leviticus 2:1 says, "Now when anyone presents a grain offering as an offering to the Lord, his offering shall be of fine flour." We've already learned that the sacrifices and offerings, the korbanot, are best understood as ritual gifts given to God, things brought to him to draw near to his presence. The grain offering is the second type of gift that the Torah describes. The term grain offering is descriptive, but not a literal translation. The translators refer to it as a grain offering because it was made of fine flour. Some older English versions of the Bible translate it as the meal offering or the cereal offering. Ironically, the King James Version translates it as the meat offering. So you King James readers beware, there is no meat in that meat offering. The grain offering is the only vegan sacrifice in Leviticus. So why does the King James Version then call it the meat offering? Well, in King James English, the word meat did not mean flesh, as it does in modern English. The word meat referred to food in general. The Hebrew word used here does not mean grain offering or meat offering. It's the word mincha. Like the word korban, the word mincha literally means gift or tribute. Therefore, the grain offerings should be translated as gift offerings. Like a burnt offering, the mincha was not a penalty for sin. It was a free will gift to God, completely voluntary on the part of the person offering it. The basic components of the mincha offering were grain, usually wheat flour, oil, and frankincense. Like the matzah at Passover, grain offerings were always unleavened. Leaven was regarded as a symbol of fermentation and corruption. All decay and corruption are inappropriate in God's holy space. The grain offerings could be baked in an oven, fried in a pan, deep pan fried, or left uncooked. Grain offerings were brought to the altar in conjunction with other types of sacrifices like burnt offerings and peace offerings. The grain offerings were also brought by poor people who could not afford other types of sacrifices. The Torah says that every grain offering was to be salted with salt before it was placed upon the altar to symbolize the salt of the covenant of your God. In fact, all of the sacrifices were to be salted. The salt was used in the ancient world as a preservative. The salt of the covenant refers to the unchanging and eternal nature of God's covenant with Israel. Just as salt preserved foods from turning rancid in the ancient world, God's faithfulness preserves his covenant with his people. To this day, at every Sabbath table, the observant Jewish family remembers this ritual by dashing a little salt on the Sabbath bread or dipping the bread into salt before eating it, because the Talmud says, a man's table is like the altar. The third type of gift introduced by the Torah is peace offerings. We read in Leviticus chapter 3, verse 1, now if his offering is a sacrifice of peace offerings, if he is going to offer out of the herd, whether male or female, he shall offer it without defect before the Lord. They are called peace offerings because the Hebrew word shalamim is related to the word shalom, which means peace or wholeness. Like the burnt offering and the grain offering, the peace offerings were also voluntary offerings. They weren't brought for sin. There were different types of peace offerings: thanksgiving offerings, votive offerings to fulfill vows, free will offerings, and Passover lambs were also peace offerings, sacrifices in which the one bringing the animal partook. They were never brought as a penalty for sin or to earn forgiveness of sin. Like the burnt offerings, the peace offerings had to be an unblemished animal from the herds or the flocks, but the peace offering was prepared differently than the burnt offering. Only the choice fats were burned on the altar. The rest of the sacrifice, of the peace offering, was divided between the person who brought the peace offering and the priest who offered it on the altar. So the peace offering was an opportunity to share in the table of the Lord. It symbolized a shared meal between the offerer, the person bringing the sacrifice, the priesthood, and God himself, everyone getting a share of it. The peace offering represented then peace and mutual goodwill between God and the person bringing the peace offering. It represented fellowship between God and man. The meat of the peace offering was to be used for a fellowship meal, so the man who brought the offering would invite his whole family, friends, and acquaintances to partake of his feast. Peace offerings were usually offered in conjunction with the festivals. Families would travel together to Jerusalem, offer up their peace offerings, and then enjoy them together as a meal, as a component of keeping God's appointed times. Maybe that's where the tradition of big festival meals comes from in the first place.